So thanks very much. Thanks, Remy. Yes, my name's Phil Hawksworth, and until quite recently, I worked at an agency in London called The Team. And on Monday, I start a new life at another agency, RGA. And as Remy says, I'm here to talk about excessive enhancement. And I'm particularly excited to be at Full Frontal today. And I was rather excited also when I found that people were keen to hear about this, and there was a bit of kind of conversation on Twitter about, or looking forward to hearing Phil Hawksworth talk on excessive enhancement, except there's a bit of confusion. It seemed that people were excited to hear me talk about sex enhancement, which is not, that's not the subject matter of this talk, and that's not what I tried to get across in that long synopsis to Remy. Neither indeed is it sexcretion, whatever the hell that is, but there was conversation on Twitter that, oh, we're looking forward to hearing Phil talk about that. I don't know if it's linked to the fact that it's the Full Frontal hashtag that people are misusing. Sexcrement, I don't know what the hell that is, but people seem to be thinking that I was going to be talking about that. None of that is true. I'm going to be talking about excessive enhancement, and let me see if I can explain a little bit. So, some context. I was one of the people who stood up because I've been here for the last 3 years, or the last 2 years rather, attending this conference. And of course there's a real background in great talks here, talking about JavaScript and browser technologies, and of course there's a real front-end focus. This is Full Frontal, it's about front-end development. So there's a lot of talk about bleeding edge effects in the browsers, kind of browser optimization and performance, and kind of browser shizzle, which is an expression that an old colleague of mine likes to use, kind of the exciting things you can do in the browser. And I was really encouraged in the first year here, the very last talk, Simon Willison gave a really interesting talk on Node.js where it really justifies bringing JavaScript into the server side as well. I think it was the first time I'd seen a good use of JavaScript in the server. And now after that talk, I went home and I wanted to find out more about that particular subject. And I'll tell you what, it's a brave person who hits search in Google for that particular query. And I found myself wanting to add the occasional kind of additional search parameter to that. Flesh tones, Christ knows what I really wanted to go for. But it's really interesting, I think, to see that now we've got JavaScript legitimately in the back end and the front end, so we're really catering for the whole pantomime cow of web development. But of course, here at Full Frontal, there's a particular focus quite often on the kind of exciting things we can do in the browser, and it's a particularly exciting time right now, I think, in web development, particularly in front end development. We can do animations now, we can do exciting kind of 3D effects and all kinds of interesting data visualizations and dynamic stuff that we can do in the browser. So there's lots of excitement and lots of possibilities for us at the moment. So I guess really what I'm here to do today is kind of just issue a slight word of caution. And I'm a little bit apprehensive doing that into this particular crowd because we're all excited about what we can do. But if you're not going to take it from me, kind of consider what Jeff Goldblum would have said in Jurassic Park, where he had these sage words of, the scientists were so preoccupied with whether they could, they didn't think about whether they should. And I think that's really apt at the moment because all of these exciting possibilities for us, and we're ready to steamroll into it. And in this context, there were some particular repercussions. And maybe we're not all at risk of being eaten by dinosaurs, but there are certainly risks inherent in what we're doing. So the risk for me at this point is really to be Captain Killjoy for this conference. There's going to be lots of interesting technical demonstrations throughout the day, and I don't really want to be the guy who's telling you not to run with scissors or to eat with your mouth open. But we're web developers, and what we're concerned with is the web, so this stuff is important. I think back a little while ago, about 4 years ago, I guess, when I worked an open source innovations team at BT called Osmosoft. And we were tasked one day when we were going to an event, we were asked if a couple of us would create some drawings for kind of these kind of pull-ups at the side, kind of to go on the stand. And I like to think that I can kind of push pixels around and kind of care for how things look. And I was kind of the developer who was also a bit of a designer in that group. So I went off and I kind of fired up Photoshop. And I was very much concerned with, making sure the drop shadows look right and making sure the reflections are right. A friend of mine, a colleague at the time, Paul Downey, instead got out his felt tips and he poured his brain onto this piece of paper and he produced something which many of you may have seen before. It's this drawing called The Webber's Agreement. And it really is this kind of uber-doodle. It's quite startling. If you haven't seen it before, it got just a crap ton of hits on Flickr the next day, while my kind of beautifully sculpted but ultimately meaningless bit of content got kind of ignored. And there's some lovely kind of messages in this drawing, with the path kind of paved with the URI, which is the building block of the web, and kind of it goes up to kind of the good processes on one side, and some of the kind of darker approaches, kind of governed by Mordorsoft over there on one side. And I think there's some really nice little messages, and I'll include the links to this in the slides so you can get at these. But you know, I particularly like it, you know, on the side of openness and collaboration. You've got the Creative Commons, which, you know, snaking across that as the paved cow paths of microformats, and you know, and the principles mound, which is atop by the W3C and IETF and what have you. And I also rather like this as well, the passport fracture on some kind of commentary about identity, which has got the open ID repair. And this kind of influenced me quite a lot. And just as I was kind of finished consuming this, Paul came out with another ridiculous uber doodle, this time called the URI as the thing. And I'm not going to try and show you through the content of this because, frankly, it's just incredibly, incredibly dense, and I wouldn't be able to do it justice. But you know, it's worth kind of zooming in on one little bit of it, just to see the cookie monster that you've got to be aware of, and this fantastic maze of how you navigate the labyrinth of the web and the importance of the back button and breadcrumb trails and all of that good stuff. And so, you know, one of the things that really came across to me here, and I found was quite influential, was this concept of agreement on the web and the contract of the URI and how important the URI is. And I don't want to turn this this into a lecture on REST. That's not what we're here for. But as I say, it's a bit of a cautionary tale, because with all of the toys that we've got available to us now, I think that we're at risk of making some of the same mistakes that we've made and collectively we've kind of sneered at in the past. And so kind of we're forgetting some of the fundamentals about things like, you know, over HTTP, if you do a GET request to a resource, you should be getting a representation of the content that's there that lives at that resource. You know, it's very much a concept of, you know, ask and you shall receive. And I think we're putting some of that at the back of our minds a little bit and really getting seduced by what's possible. And I think it's a very seductive power with all of the toys that we've got available in our toy chest now. And you know, the big sticker across that toy chest, of course, is HTML5, and we all have slightly different understandings of what that means. You know, I think a lot of our bosses, and particularly our clients, think of HTML5 as everything snazzy you can do in a browser now. I mean, we all know that that's not what that is, but of course, you know, I'm using that convenient term myself right now, just to lump all of these exciting things together, HTML5, CSS3, WebGL, all of the kind of browser APIs that you've got to do exciting stuff. And I think we as a community of web developers in the past have been a little bit guilty of sneering at Flash. And right now we're making the same mistakes, potentially, that have been made with Flash already. I'm not a Flash hater, although when I joined my job a while ago, one of the Flash developers and designers there heard me espousing the kind of the good stuff about the web and open standards and branded me immediately a member of the anti-Flash mob, which is kind of a moniker I kind of enjoyed. But I certainly think that I'm guilty, and I think many of us are guilty of having a slightly kind of snooty attitude towards Flash, because you know we're fighting on the right side of the Webber's Agreement for openness and collaboration, and Flash is this proprietary thing that we kind of sneer at. And we look down on it quite a lot. But I think there are some lessons to be learned, and there are obviously some common criticisms of Flash that are worth keeping in mind. The one that comes to mind immediately is of frozen content, right? I mean, lots of websites, containers of Flash delivered over the web. You know, we criticize them for not being able to often copy and paste the content out of there, not being able to bookmark the addresses that we find there because they're not updating the URI as you navigate. Maybe they're not very good for accessibility, or the content isn't discoverable often by the Googlebot and web spiders and what have you. And whenever I tend to kind of level these kind of criticisms against a Flash developer, I almost always get exactly the same response, and that is, well, Flash can do it, which always elicits the same response of me. Great, show me, you should point me to an example. And every now and again, there is an example where many of those criticisms are kind of put to one side and someone's done a really good job. But more often than not, the examples that you find are examples of where the care has been for the pixels and the experience and the way things behave, rather than the web and the kind of fundamentals that make browsers work and make browsers do a good job. And you kind of have to ask yourself why that is. And I think a little bit that maybe it's about what is valued by the developer who's put that together in the first place. And you know, when you talk to various Flash developers and Flash designers, you know, they've arrived at Flash by, first of all, becoming amazing at Photoshop, and they're kind of artists and designers first. And then through the various kind of Macromedia or Adobe suites, they've arrived at Flash and started developing things there and brought out more kind of interactions and then built, notionally, a website. And this speaks to me more about kind of caring for the sex appeal of what's there than about the web. And that seems very, very familiar at the moment. And so, you know, again, we're just kind of thinking about the seductive power of what's possible. If we kind of look back a little way to how the web was a while ago and how websites were a while ago, I think it's fair to say that we've been on a bit of a journey, and there's just massively increased sophistication now, not just in browsers and the kind of technologies that we can bring to bear in the browser, but also sophistication of the designs and how these things look and how they behave. And then, of course, the sophistication also of the user and what their expectation is. And as a result, I think, you know, we're starting to really try to stitch together much richer user experiences and much more engaging experiences for the user in the browser. If we look at an example from about 15 years ago, McDonald's website, which you'll notice is red. I don't know if you can read any of that. I can't even read it from here, to be honest. But you know, you arrive at this page, you know, 15 or so years ago, and you're presented with a landing page. And you know, the users weren't that sophisticated at the time, so they needed to be explained to how you get into the site. So you know, there would be instructions to click on the golden arches, because this is just the hello page. And once you get in there, then you're presented with a slightly less sophisticated page than we might expect now. And again, you know, rather than anything else, I mean, the most important thing here apparently seems to be the fine print. I don't know what's down there, but all the content you get here really is instructions for the user to say, you know, if you're a child, click on the children in the images above. You go through to the children's content. If you're a grown-up, click on the grown-ups, and you go through to the adult content on McDonald's. The mind boggles again what McDonald's adult content might have been, but thinking sexy hamburgers. So if we contrast that with a website from more recently, many of you may have seen this. I don't know if anyone here was involved in working on this. Excellent. That's good. I must admit, I don't know which agency worked on this for Volkswagen. I know who worked with them in London, but I think it's probably a different agency in Germany. And this site certainly delivers a rich and exciting and very engaging user experience. And yay, it uses open web standards, so we won. It wasn't in Flash. Fantastic. But the problem is, I kind of think it sucks a little bit. And so if we go and take a look at actually what the website looks like, go to beetle.de. Okay, great. So that took us around about 13 seconds, and what that gave us was some instructions on how to use the website. You know, it tells us to just scroll. So that doesn't feel like we've actually come a very long way from the McDonald's site that gave us a holding page, like a bit of a landing page, a loading page, and then presented us with some instructions. 13 seconds is an eternity for visiting a website. You know, it's an absolute age. But there are good reasons why it takes so long to arrive at that. And in those 13 seconds, what's happening is it's pulling down about 11 megabytes of images, and it's doing that over a whopping 251 individual HTTP requests. And the interesting thing is that when you look at those HTTP requests, a vast majority of those, they're missing any kind of cache expiration information on the headers of those resources. So your browser can't really cache those, so you're going to get those again next time. So So it's pretty heavyweight stuff. And as you kind of scroll through, because remember the instructions told you to scroll, there's no navigation. As you scroll through that, that kind of rises, because you know it lazily loads in some additional resources, the next 4 megabytes of images to get you through there. And the number of HTTP requests rises to around 316 when I was logging it. And you know, car websites seem to have a bit of a history of doing very ambitious and exciting things and not always pulling it off. I don't know if you've had the good fortune to ever visit Ling's Cars, but this is a case study of, let's say, a particular design aesthetic on the web. And so you would imagine that, bloody hell, Merck SLK, you'd imagine that Ling's Cars probably doesn't maybe embrace the best of the web development approaches that there are. But contrasted to the initial 11 meg footprint of the last site, this comes in at a slim 4 megabytes of images. And yes, it's still got a crap load of HTTP requests, but 314 is actually 2 less than what we were expecting, or what we found with the Volkswagen site. So if we pop back in there and we follow the instructions, I imagine that a lot of you have seen this, because I think it certainly did the rounds and people were looking at it. And this is really cool. I mean, as you're scrolling down, there are all kinds of fantastic CSS3 transitions and all kinds of effects that are going on there. These images, of course, rather than being sprited into one image for a single HTTP request, there's lots and lots of images. And we know better than that now, right? We know how to do this stuff a little bit better to reduce the number of HTTP requests and all of the overheads there. There are lots of tools around for helping us build sprites and what have you. And as we navigate through here, we start seeing different kind of user interface kind of paradigms, like the familiar carousel there, and the navigation updates in the primary navigation. And of course, this car, of course, it roars and it tweets because it's a modern thing, so it's got to have a Twitter integration. Can't help thinking that Jeff Goldblum would have had a little something to say about this. In fact, I think if you pressed him, he'd probably say, that really is rather a lot of HTTP requests for a website about a car. I think that's in the director's cut. So, we're in real danger here of being eaten by those dinosaurs. And of course, when all of this was being designed, I imagine, at the agency that's put this together, there's probably someone exactly like me saying, no, we shouldn't build it in Flash. We definitely shouldn't build it in Flash. We want to build this one, so we want it to go everywhere. So we're going to build it with modern web technologies, with all of the cool things we can do in the browser. Right? This is exactly what leads us down this line, if we don't do it properly. We can always argue that if we're going to use open web technologies and not use Flash, it's going to work on the iPhone. I've got a MacBook Pro over here with 8 gigabytes of RAM, and I could cook a steak on it when I run that website. It's not going to work particularly well on the iPhone. And in fact, if you go to beetle.de, what happens when you're on your laptop or not on a mobile device is it redirects you to the full experience, the one that we've been looking at. If, in fact, you look at it on a mobile device, it redirects you instead to the reduced experience. And I have to be honest, the reduced experience on the iPhone is pretty nice. It's pretty nicely done. It's well designed, it looks beautiful, and it performs really well. But it kind of negates the fact, if we're going to put one website onto the desktop and one website onto the mobile, it kind of makes you think, well, maybe the approach that we took for the website traditionally might not have been the best after all. If we just take, I don't want to just rail on this website for the entire time, but if we just kind of look at it once again. As you're navigating by clicking the global navigation here, if you look really closely, there is a URI, there is an address for this stuff. So that makes me think, okay, great, well, there's some good principles at play here. We're hijacking the links and we're just progressively enhancing them with the JavaScript when it's available. But you'll notice that as you navigate, the address bar doesn't change at all. So that's not discoverable for the user. No one can actually bookmark that. And that's exactly the kind of criticism we had of Flash in the past. Also, if you take the trouble to hit those addresses directly, if you actually capture the address and go and put it in your browser, it just redirects you here anyway, because it doesn't understand it. So it's just a real shame. The bit that we just saw as you scroll with the car moving, that elicited a completely different response from my same colleague who was telling me that I was a member of the anti-Flash mob. His response was, why don't the fucking wheels fucking move? And And I think that illustrated a point really beautifully, that, you know, he was someone who'd come from the design side, and I was someone who cared, you know, more heavily about the fundamentals of the web. And between us, we were both annoyed with this site, but for different reasons. So, you know, he was caring much more about the pixels than the web, and I was caring much more about the web than the pixels. And it feels like that we were both poorly served. And frankly, you know, maybe that would have just been better off and better performing had it been in Flash. Okay, so I promise I'll move on from this site soon, but you know, there's a standard thing that you kind of tend to do when you look at how well a site's been put together and how well it lives as a citizen of the web, and that's to look at it without JavaScript, right? So let's take a quick glance of it. And you know, when you come here, you get the loading screen, but you get nothing else because there's no content here. This isn't a website. This is the endpoint for an application. JavaScript users aren't completely non-JavaScript users rather aren't completely left behind. You'll spot that you know they've used the NoScript tag to vomit onto the page, just a little line that says "Screw you, go and enable JavaScript," and that's a pretty nasty experience. Okay? I mean that kind of leaves you feeling like there's nothing there at all. Because what is the address of the content? You know, how do you get to the content on this page? You know, we've completely forgotten about the URI and the importance of the URI. And with the URIs are the building blocks of the web. They're what make the web a web of content. And so I worry a little bit that we're perhaps forgetting about how the web works, but I don't think that's it. I think we're just kind of you know, seduced by the possible, and the fact that we could do all of these things has just made us want to do it more. You're probably thinking that I just don't really care about the exciting stuff, and I promise you that's not true. I'm as much of a magpie as anyone else when it comes to looking at exciting shizzle in the browser, but I just think you should be able to get the content of a web page by doing something simple. An obvious and kind of high-profile example of this that I'm sure you're all familiar with, but let's look at it again, is Twitter. And Twitter, have got a very stable stance of this. They say Twitter.com isn't a website, except, you know, of course, you know, it is. That's what it looks like. And you know, you go to this, and if you're authenticated as a user, you get your content. It's an offering on the web. But Twitter are kind of sensible, and they say, well, no, Twitter isn't a website. Twitter's a platform, and everything uses the Twitter API. And there are obviously, you know, good reasons for doing that. And the website that we know, actually, they refer to even as the Twitter web client. They're adamant to kind of not talk about it as a website. So let's do the standard thing, you know, let's take a look at this without JavaScript, because hopefully things have been built with a progressive enhancement kind of approach to leave nobody behind. And you know, we're back to this experience again. It's kind of the lonely, lost experience of an empty container. The argument that you often hear when you say, well, let's look at it without JavaScript is, well, nobody is experiencing it without JavaScript at the moment. Everyone has JavaScript enabled. And that's, you know, that's not true. There are lots of situations and lots of devices that don't understand the logic that they've got to go through to parse the content with JavaScript. And also, you know, what about the contract of the URI? What about the fact that there's meant to be content at the end of this? This isn't an app store, this is the web. And so really, the experience you're getting here is, well, that content's just not known at this address. Now, Twitter made use of this, right? The hashbang or the shebang pattern. And so don't judge me for putting Ricky Martin on the screen for a bad pun. This is enabling me to play degrees of Simon Willison. I've managed to navigate from Simon Willison to Ricky Martin in just 61 slides. So no matter how many exciting things you hear from the other speakers today, no one else, I imagine, is going to have done that. So I would imagine. Okay. But what, you know, why use the hashbang? No, why use it? Well, it started off using just the hash, right? Because the hash is really useful for JavaScript developers to use. You know, we could read it and we could set it using window.location.hash. And doing so enabled us to update the URI without refreshing the page, which meant that we could do all kinds of client-side routing and kind of client-side processing. And you could see why Twitter, for instance, would want to do that, because it means they can offset some of the heavy lifting they've got to do and just offer just a single API. And of course, the other thing that it means that you get is you get access to the history navigation. You know, you enable this back button, which is so precious and is one of the things that we often criticize Flash for not being able to do. And so, you know, Google took that, and since the hash has a meaning. It's intended to be a location within that page. They wanted to really formalize that and make sure that they could use it as a pattern that they could use to get at that hidden content, the content that wasn't on the web, the content that you had to get through by doing some JavaScript processing and making additional requests to an API or what have you. So they kind of codified this as the hash bang and you know, created this project for the Google Ajax crawling. And you can get to this and read about it and find out how you should behave in order to be a good citizen for Google doing this kind of stuff. But it kind of makes me worry a little bit because the content there is hard to get at. So what does it take now to crawl the web? You know, how many technologies and what does it take to actually write a good spider and a good Google bot of your own these days? Because the bar is just raised so high. But you know, this kind of interface shizzle that these kind of practices enable, the kind of client-side activities, those don't have to break the URI anymore. And I think a really good example for this is what happens on GitHub. Is there anyone who works at GitHub in the room? Okay, well, if there was, I'd probably give you an inappropriately long hug, because I think that GitHub is just a wonderful resource, and I think that fantastic work is done there. And you're all probably very familiar with GitHub and what a project page looks like. And on this particular example, and we'll come back to this project in a second. But the code view down at the bottom, they started doing something which I thought was kind of interesting, and it's something that was possible for a long time, but they resisted until they could do it properly. And that is when you navigate through the code view, you've all seen it. Instead of doing an entire page refresh, it just uses a bit of Ajax, goes off and asynchronously grabs some content, pulls it into the DOM, and then uses a CSS3 transition to kind of give you that nice kind of continuous and kind of easy experience through the code. And that's been possible for a while, and lots of people could have done similar things. But what I really like is the fact that they kind of resisted doing that until they could also take care of the important thing at the top. So as you're navigating through the bottom, it's updating the URI properly, and it's updating this in a way that isn't breaking the web, and it's not using any hacks that we just had to kind of make do with, like the shebang. And what they're doing here, of course, is they're using the history API from HTML5. And that is actually just a JavaScript API for the browser. And this is the only bit of code I'm going to show today, because this is more really about the why than the how. But it's fairly simple what they're doing here. I mean, just using a bit of jQuery, they're listening for the click events of the anchor tags in their slider element, and then they're calling push state on the history object, and pushing into there, passing into there an object that describes the path. Another parameter which is not supported by many browsers, which is a title for that page, but you can just pass in an empty string, and then the URI that they're navigating through, and then they just carry on. That updates the address bar for them, and it injects that into the history objects of the browser, and they can carry on with their Ajax request to update the UI. Now, at the other side of the coin, they're also kind of listening for the pop state event, which is what's triggered by using the navigation buttons, and they're intercepting that and they're updating their UI accordingly. And this kind of routing and this kind of processing is very fashionable at the moment, very useful in single page applications and kind of applications that are delivered over the web and they're kind of self-contained in single page apps. And it's really worth taking the care to look after the URI even in those conditions. And there are some really helpful kind of helper libraries to do that. And Levi Roots is the one that we were actually just looking at a second ago by Paul Kinlan from Google. This is a really lovely little project, and it's tiny. It's like a 2K JavaScript. It's like a 2K JavaScript library, and it's really unobtrusively implemented, so you don't have to mess with the HTML. You just drop this in, and then you can use a method of progressive enhancement for listening for the pop state in the browser, and for programmatically updating your UI based on what's being navigated through using the navigate buttons. And so it kind of leads me on to the importance of demos and developer tools. I'm starting to run a little short on time. But this, of course, is a really important piece of the puzzle. there are so, I mean, I think we've probably all cobbled together some little kind of demonstration site to demonstrate a really kind of exciting thing that we've discovered. And you know, this is a classic, you know, Adobe are jumping very much in on the HTML5 umbrella bandwagon. And you know, this site, the Expressive Web, you know, shows off all kinds of CSS animations, CSS3 animations, and you know, you can control it and make this guy jump really high and do all kinds of, you know, fun bits and pieces. But you know, this is also falling a little bit short because, again, it's just a demo site. But you know, you do the classic thing of turning off JavaScript and taking a little look at it, and the Expressive Web suddenly feels a little bit less expressive. Again, this is just a container, and you'll also notice that there, well, you can barely see, I'm afraid, up at the top there. But again, they're using, you know, the shebang to enable the kind of navigation through their environment that they'd want you to have. But if this is a site that's targeting modern browsers and modern techniques and HTML5, then they're also targeting browsers that have got access to the history API. So why aren't they making good use of that? And I think more examples on the web that are using this kind of pattern, kind of, we all draw from that, and we kind of think that is, you know, the way it's done as a result. And so, you know, yes, this is just a demo, but I think Bruce Lawson put it really nicely when he said the biggest danger is when the demo mentality leaks into production websites. And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I've been guilty of that myself in the past because, you know, as I said, I like the shizzle as well. I like the exciting stuff in the browser. And, you know, there's an example I recall from, again, like 4 years ago, where I was just tremendously smug with myself when, while on my commute, on the train, I saw in Twitter that one of my colleagues had put together a really nice example of a slideshow. You know, it goes off and grabs a load of content from Flickr and it pulls it in and it creates this amazing slideshow for you with all kinds of snazzy transitions and what have you. So I followed the link on my phone on the train and it was a Flash application, so it was just an empty box. Didn't work for me. And so, you know, I kind of smugly thought, well, you know, I can cobble this together very easily with a bit of JavaScript, lean on jQuery a little bit, and just do this on the train. And so I put this thing together, which, you know, it's exactly what you'd expect. You know, it's doing the same thing. You stick in a tag, and then it goes off to Flickr, and it pulls them back. It does it incredibly inefficiently, by the way. You know, it grabs everything it can, it just pulls it in, makes loads of requests, and then it starts rendering them onto this kind of display in using some simple kind of JavaScript and CSS animation techniques. You know, that's what you all look like at the moment. And it pulls those things in. Disgraceful. And I was really pleased with myself because, yes, it ran on the iPhone, and I could, you know, I demonstrated a particular point. And I was also smug because I was, you know, I was using this trick of updating the hash so that these things were going to be bookmarkable, so you could share this via the bookmark. But really, you know, this kind of thing now is a demo that's out there, and people, you know, not many people, but you know, the point is still there that people refer to it as, you know, this is a way that you can do stuff, and people talk about it as, well, this is the right way to do things, and rather than going down the bad Flash route, we do the open web standards route. I think it's a little bit counterproductive sometimes to have these demos that aren't making the best use of the tools. And just kind of a final comment really on developer tools. Obviously, development tools are starting to really mature around, you know, helping us with building stuff for HTML5 and all of the stuff that lives under that umbrella. Adobe, again, are kind of getting in here, and you know, open web folks rejoice because Edge is coming. And the tools that are available to us there really help us create these kind of effects very, very easily. But I kind of worry that maybe that is also another example of just automating this for us so that we don't really think about what we're doing and what and how we're looking after the web as the platform that we're sitting atop of. You know, I think we've all had experience in the past of when things have, tools have helped us create something and put something together. And so really my message, sorry to be the wet blanket that's saying there's all this exciting stuff, be careful how you play with it. What I really think is, what I want to say is, you must experiment and you must explore, but regardless of whether you're building a web application which is delivered over the web, or you're building a website. You know, I think we really must take good care of the web, because it's what feeds us ultimately, and also you should chew with your mouth closed. The slides for this will be released under a Creative Commons license. I'll be tweeting later on where they are. Thanks to everyone who let me use their images on there, and also there's a bunch of links on there for the various resources that I've looked at. So with that, thanks very much, and enjoy the rest of the day. If you want.
Phil has time for questions. Does anyone have a question for Phil? We've got a couple of questions. No, we've got a question at the back. It's Jake. While they're taking the mic, did anyone notice that his picture didn't have a neck? He didn't have a neck, which was weird. Your yes. Avatar didn't have a neck. That was freaking me out.
Yes.
Hey, so we've actually had a question through from Twitter from someone who couldn't be here, from Ling's Cars. She says, "Oi, Phil Hawksworth.
Yes.
What the hell are you saying about me? This better be good, or I chew your head off."
Wonderful.
By the way, who are you?
Above all else, that's what I wanted to achieve today. So I'm on Ling's radar, so that's all. The rest of you, knackers to that. So. Any more? Another at the back?
Going back to the Beatles site, how would you answer it when the marketing agency behind it says, well, it went viral, it worked, we don't give a damn beyond that?
Well, absolutely, and you know, that's exactly the kind of thing that I have to face all the time. That's exactly the point of a lot of these sites, to get them into the eyeballs of as many people as possible. And it very may well be that, you know, that site was very successful in making people aware of the car and the product. But I think ultimately it's a responsibility for us as web professionals to make sure that we're crafting something that doesn't damage the environment that we're working on. It may very well have been successful for that particular client, but I think there's a responsibility particularly for people who work in agencies, who are creating things that are flagship sites all over the web, that we're doing so in such a way that doesn't harm the web. And I think that those kind of effects could have been built in such a way, with just a tiny bit more care and a tiny bit more attention, that could have serviced both needs. So I think it's a fair criticism, but I think the importance is that we need to also look after the web.
That's all the time we've got for questions. You can go and nab them during the break. So can you just thank Jeremy and Phil again for me?